Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
I certainly hope so.
On wanting to hear back from producers, a two-way conversation, Marcia Bunger is administrator of USDA's Risk Management Agency on the upcoming livestock roadshows.
That is also a main objective of these workshops and roadshows, is that not only we are providing information, but that we're also hearing feedback. So do not be shy when you're either attending the virtual or in person. We need to know how some of these products are working for you, what's not working for you, because we are not a stagnant operation. We continue to tweak and modify and revise and add to that toolbox that you're talking about.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
It's a challenge.
Kyle Kunkler is Director of Government Affairs, American Soybean Association, on the challenge of staying on top of regulation.
Congress, they, you know, pass various laws in you know, that can require all sorts of regulatory requirements for a variety of different reasons. Perhaps it's, you know, environmental purposes, or, you know, it's wanting to minimize risks to human health or things of that sort. And it's up to the regulatory agencies to then take those laws and figure out ways to implement them. And a lot of the times that the way that those agencies seek to implement those laws can be fairly detrimental to farming operations and might be incompatible with how agriculture works. And so it's our job to work, in government affairs, and especially those that work frequently with the regulatory agencies, to help them understand how agriculture works. Increasingly, far fewer Americans are participating in food production and are, further removed from the farm. And they don't really have that firsthand perspective. So it's up to us who work in this regulatory policy space to help them cut through the clutter, to see and to understand how farming and agriculture works, what's going to work, what's not. And make sure that when they're implementing these laws, they do so in a way that's not going to harm our farmers and our food, feed, and fiber producers.
Also talks about the importance of helping EPA understand what happens on the farm.
Those spray drift buffers that EPA is requiring under this proposal could be significant. Maximum up to 500 feet for aerial application and up to 200 feet for ground sprays. There are ways you can reduce those, again, by putting in place things like tree windbreaks and things like that, or using hooded sprayers, but, not a lot of solutions that are very workable, and it could run the risk of farmers having to leave, enormous swaths of their fields untreated, just to continue using herbicides moving forward. So, you ask a question, what can we do to help EPA find a better way? Well, part of one of the ways that EPA has reached these very unreasonable ideas is one, sort of not understanding where agricultural producers are coming from. So we're helping to instruct them and tell them what's going to be workable and what's not. But honestly, we think the EPA needs to just, start from a position of trying to better understand, well, what are the actual risks of pesticides to species? And right now, they make very, very conservative assumptions when they're trying to figure that out. They assume, for example, that if you look at a pesticide label, they look at that and say, well, how much are growers actually out there spraying? And they say, and look at that, whatever the label maximum rate is, that's what they assume. So in cases of like Roundup, for example, on soybeans, you could use up to 6 pounds per acre. But we know there's good data out there that shows that that's not what farmers are spraying. They're spraying, a quarter of that, if that even. And that makes a big difference when you're trying to figure out, what are your risks to wildlife? EPA also assumes that there is zero conservation going on right now. They assume that no one is using reduced tillage, no one is using cover crops, no one is using any of these conservation practices that are going to have a protective effect on wildlife. So our answer to EPA right now is, one, not only do they need to do a better job of trying to figure out and understand agriculture and what's going to work and what's not, but they need to do a better job also of using good science and good data to even understand what the risks to species are. And I think that they're going to find the vast majority of species out there aren't at risk the way that they think they are. And for those that may truly be at risk, we can find some good common sense solutions to both protect the species and allow for farmers to continue to access these tools moving forward.
This is Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Through my decade of service to USDA and now seeing impacts from the pandemic and more frequent and intense natural disasters, I've gained a much deeper understanding of the challenges our producers face and the ways our safety net programs are instrumental in keeping families on the land and helping them build more resilient operations.
Robert Bonney is Undersecretary for Food Production and Conservation at USDA.
At FPAC, I have the honor to work with USDA's producer-facing agencies as we partner with farmers, ranchers, and forest owners to strengthen American agriculture and forestry. All four FPAC agencies, FSA, RMA, NRCS, and the FPAC Business Center, are engaging producers in new and more effective ways, streamlining program delivery, opening the doors of agriculture to all, and providing a more effective and holistic farm safety net. Since 2021, this administration has delivered pandemic assistance through CFAP and other programs in a way that provides invaluable assistance to producers while expanding the number of customers able to access aid. This approach and our other to CFAP and our other programs has meant we are reaching an estimated 50,000 more customers per year as compared to pre-pandemic levels. To expedite the distribution of the $10 billion in emergency relief funds provided by Congress in 2021, FSA and RMA leveraged existing data to streamline the application process and get money to producers faster than previous ad hoc programs. By year's end, FSA had processed more than 350,000 applications, totaling over $8 billion in payments to livestock, commodity, and specialty crop producers to help offset eligible losses from 2020 and 2021. We estimate that the design of the Emergency Relief Program and the Emergency Livestock Relief Program saved over 1 million hours of staff time and equally significant time for producers as well. The 2023 omnibus provided direction to FPAC to assist rice producers impacted by high input costs. FSA and RMA are working to build on our experience from the emergency relief we provided in 2022 to create a process that will be easy for producers and our staff. The omnibus also provided funds for broader ad hoc disaster payments. While we are thankful for what Congress has provided, the funding provided won't allow us to provide a comparable level of relief for producers with 2022 losses as compared to those impacted by 2021 and 2020 losses. Even with these ad hoc programs, I want to also reiterate that crop insurance remains a critical, a vital risk management tool for our producers. RMA is expanding coverage to more crops and producers than ever before. RMA's whole farm and microfarm policies are providing new opportunities for diversified producers and small-scale operators. For the livestock sector, the pasture, rangeland, and forage program now covers more than 250 million acres. USDA has also taken significant steps to support producers who rely on our farm loans. Thanks to passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, FSA was able to provide once-in-a-generation assistance to keep many of our borrowers in business. Approximately 11,000 delinquent direct and guaranteed borrowers had their accounts brought current with USDA's announcement in October. USDA also paid the next scheduled annual installment for qualified direct loan borrowers, giving them peace of mind in the near term, while Administrator Ducheneau and the FSA team consider other options to fully leverage the remaining assistance made available by Congress.
Robert Bonney, Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation at USDA. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Lesser prairie chickens are a species of prairie grouse. There's several different species of grouse, and a few of those are ones that are specific to living in the prairie.
Drew Ricketts is a Kansas State Wildlife Extension Specialist.
They are what we call a prairie obligate species, which basically means they can't exist without prairie. They also need relatively big chunks of prairie, so we think of them as sort of being a big landscape bird. And when we manage for a critter like this, we manage on a landscape scale. So just some examples of how much prairie they might need. Thinking on a smaller scale, within 1 mile, we would need about 60% grassland cover within that 1 mile in order to have enough for that small spot to be occupied by a lesser prairie chicken from a broader perspective, ideally 70% of a 30-square-mile area would be grassland. There also needs to be a fair bit of heterogeneity within that grassland cover, and that's a word that we use a lot as biologists, but basically it means that there's a mix of different cover types on the landscape. So for lekking, which is the mating ritual or the dancing that they do in the springtime that everybody sees the cool videos of, they need areas of very short grass. They like those, if possible, to be at higher elevation points on the landscape so they can be seen from a long ways. For nesting, they need areas with relatively dense cover, so it'd be hard to see through, and that cover is going to be 13 to 30 inches tall, or an easy way to think about that would be like shin to hip height, and that's going to be the nesting cover. In most of the areas occupied by lesser prairie chickens in Kansas, that cover is going to be provided by tall grass species. In other parts of their range, it might be provided by sagebrush or a shrub oak called sand chinnery oak. And then for the brooding period, when they're raising their chicks, they need these areas that are relatively open at the ground level, but have sort of a canopy of broadleaf plants above. So that canopy is going to provide protection, and those broadleaf plants are going to provide food. They're also going to, most importantly, from a food standpoint, provide cover and habitat for soft-bodied arthropods, which are really the most important food source for those chicks when they're growing. Sort of the last thing about their habitat requirements is they avoid vertical structures, including trees. And this is one of those things that can be especially detrimental to the species. And it's most pronounced during the nesting season. But to think about what we mean by avoiding structures, more than one tree per acre is really too many for lesser prairie chickens to want to be in an area. And areas with zero trees per acre are 40 times more likely to be used than areas with five trees per acre. So that just sort of puts that into perspective for us.
What does it mean when we say umbrella species?
The classification as an umbrella species relates back to how many different habitat requirements they have. In wildlife management, we refer to species whose habitat requirements encompass the requirements of a bunch of other species as an umbrella species. So basically, the needs for, let's say, horned larks and other species of birds or critters that are going to be in western Kansas are all included within the many things that a lesser prairie chicken needs to thrive. They're an indicator species because they need that good intact land cover, and that includes heterogeneity that's representative of healthy prairie. So if they're present, it means that it's basically a healthy ecosystem, at least at the local scale. And the boom-bust population dynamics basically refers to the fact that sometimes this species does really well and sometimes it does really poorly all in the same places. And that's mostly driven by annual variation in precipitation. So this species can really bust because of poor nest success and chick survival during droughts or even when there's too much rain. So they kind of need the right amount of precipitation.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The trade agenda has been kind of lacking in certain respects. There's a lot of games that are being played by our foreign competitors. Look no further than even just south of us with Mexico and what they've said with respect to corn.
Tom Sell with Combest Sell and Associates.
These trade challenges are always motivated by something, and usually it's a degree of competition and wanting to elevate domestic industry over the domestic industry over the needs of their consumers. We as the U.S. have the lowest trade barriers and the most transparent trade policy in the world right now. Maybe EU would be close, but they're bad actors on a lot of ag trade issues. So we need a very strong trade agenda. And again, this is one of those things where when we're organized around a farm bill, we can actually pursue some good trade agendas. This is another one of the things that's important in the farm bill. We have programs like MAP and FMD that need to be funded through a farm bill to help us compete and level the playing field and gain relationships, build relationships to access those foreign markets. Taxes is another big issue. You know, we had the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in the Trump administration in 2017. A lot of those tax benefits are going to expire at the end of next year, at the end of 2024. And so a lot of those things will have to be re-upped. Think about estate taxes. Think about some of the tools like Section 179 depreciation or bonus depreciation. Even things like cash-based accounting for agriculture have been in the crosshairs in the past. The 17 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was a very good bill for agriculture in terms of how you can manage tax liability on your farm. pay what you do, but you have some tools there at your disposal that can help farmers in the volatile nature of our business year to year. So tax policies are very important, and we're going to be very focused on that in 2024. And then regulatory policy. Look, this Biden administration does want to remake our American economy. I'm not exaggerating that. President Biden says it in his own way, right? And much of the focus is on climate smart type of policies, coupled with the belief that climate change is a potentially catastrophic issue for the world. And so this has motivated most recently the Inflation Reduction Act, funny name, right, for a bill that spent a lot of money and probably caused some forms of inflation. But nevertheless, that's the creativity of politicians, right? Just call it, name it, and claim it the Inflation Reduction Act. It was a big bill, tons, significant tax measures related to clean energy, so-called renewable energy, and those types of things. These are also, some of those are going to be set to expire at the end of next year. Some have a longer clock than that. But this is big, big business in Washington, D.C., and it's important to fight for the needs of agriculture, which can be a big part of the solution, right? There's nothing that's more renewable or sustainable than agriculture, the work that y'all are doing on your farms, trying to get it better one year to the next, year after year. Improve your capacity on that farm by taking care of the soil, taking care of your water resources, and all the resources at your disposal to do a better job next year than you did this year. That is the ethic, and that is the beauty of the private property rights system that we know in the U.S., how you guys take care of your land and build it for the next generation. It's been an incredible blessing to this nation. But there's always this mantra out of Washington, D.C. that they know best, right, or this belief, the classic Washington knows best mentality. I'm from Washington, and I'm here to help. Let me tell you how things should be done to improve the way you produce on your farm. It's hubris. It creates some real problems. And you need strong organizations like PCCA, like Plains Cotton Growers and others, like the Southwest Council that we're fortunate to get to represent, to be there and be a voice for the family farmers who we believe know best how to pass it on generation to generation.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So our fiscal year starts at the beginning of October, so we've just finished our first quarter, but this meeting is very important for us because, like I said, these contractors are coming out here, and they're giving updates to all our producers about these programs that are checkoff funded.
Greg Haynes is the CEO of the Cattlemen's Beef Board, talks about how producers drive decisions.
Our board, we have 101 board members. Every one of these board members is on a program committee. There's six committees. So there's CBB members, also Federation members. So each of these committees has about 80 or about 40 people actually on them, you know, producers that are looking at this. So the contractors are giving those producers updates and talking about, you know, where the programs are going. But this is the opportunity for the producers to also give that feedback to the contractors. As they hear this, they can talk about what they like, or have you guys thought about this, or what about this? And so that helps kind of direct the contractors where they need to go and kind of enhance and continue to move these programs. So this is a super important meeting for that. There's another meeting we'll have in the summer, very similar, and that's where the contractors will bring kind of their final proposals for 2024. But again, all the producers on these committees are giving that feedback. So it's an important process to ensure, you know, the producers are engaged, involved in this. Our board, like I said, 101 people are from all over the country. So the feedback they're getting is very broad and very representative of the industry. So I think that helps really ensure that the programs are doing what they're supposed to do and meeting the demands of the producers.
Grease, you can't manage what you don't measure, which is why the CBB investments are judged.
I think evaluation is incredibly important. You know, we need to show to the producers or who are paying into this that these programs are having an impact. We're not just doing stuff to do it. And so we have a very active evaluation committee. And so every program that's out there has to report back quarterly on set goals and targets that they had set originally when that activity was approved. So they're reporting back on that, and we're tracking that quarterly, and we come out with an annual report too. And that annual report we just actually released 2 days ago. So that's on our website if anybody wants to see it. It's pretty easy to read, but it gives you really a lot of great detail on the impact that these various programs are having. We do that. But another thing that we just started a couple years ago, we call these third-party independent analysis. And so we've hired an outside contractor to come in, and each year we select just a handful of programs, and we do a deeper dive into them. And so the goal here is to look at the programs, like what's working, maybe what's not working. You know, are there other things that we could be doing to enhance this? And so we're not trying to, you know, criticize the contractors or whatever, but I think anytime you have, you know, an outside set of eyes looking at something, it may spur some, you know, some new concepts or different things you can be doing. So our goal with this is just to really drive that continuous improvement. Get the biggest impact we can have for every checkoff dollar that we're collecting, and, you know, really get that bang for the buck and create that demand for beef. So all those have been set up to do that. Again, it's very transparent. Our producers can see what's happening with that. And then we also do another return on investment study every 5 years. So we had one done in 2020. We're going to start the next one in 2024. But the impact of that has always been good. You know, the last one showed that for every dollar we're investing, we're really getting $12 back of impact to the industry. And that's pretty significant. So I think all this really shows that the checkoff's heading in the right direction and having an impact on that consumer demand.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Basically, when we homesteaded, folks figured out how to make a living on the landscape, right? They couldn't stay there if they couldn't make a living from it. And one of those ways was through cultivating it for row crop agriculture production. That's basically an immediate loss of habitat for this bird.
Drew Ricketts, Kansas State Wildlife Extension specialist on what happened to the population of the lesser prairie chicken.
Other ways are through altered disturbance regimes, so we don't have huge herds of bison roaming across the landscape and denuding it, and the fires that also attracted those bison to the areas. We don't have fire in a lot of Kansas anymore. So that's led to some woody encroachment. So that gets at the vertical structures, one tree per acre being too many, or more than one tree per acre being too many, and then development. So energy and communications infrastructure, so oil and gas development, wind turbines, smaller windmills that are for pumping water, cell towers, electric poles, and those sorts of things. So as you mentioned, you know, historically, the estimate is that at one time, Texas alone supported 2 million birds of this species prior to 1900. Now, in the last 10 years, population is varied between 17,000 and 36,000 birds of this species. So we currently, in November, this bird was listed under the Endangered Species Act, and there are two distinct population segments. So the southern distinct population segment, which is all the area in New Mexico that's occupied by this species, and also a small portion of the occupied range in northwest Texas, in that area they're listed as endangered. So that's basically as imperiled as you could be. In the rest of the Texas Panhandle, Oklahoma, eastern Colorado, and Kansas, where these birds exist, they are listed as threatened. And there's a 4D rule along with that listing that acknowledges that in order to maintain them, there may be some things that happen that every once in a while create a loss of a few individuals of this bird.
And that's why it's important to understand what take means.
Take, as defined under the Endangered Species Act, is to harm, harass, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, kill, trap, capture, or collect, or attempt to engage in any such conduct. And really, the two most important words in that sentence that I just read for producers are going to be harm or harass. So harm is further defined by the Fish and Wildlife Service to include significant habitat modification or degradation that results in death or injury to the listed species by significantly impairing behavioral patterns such as breeding, feeding, or sheltering. Harass is defined by the Fish and Wildlife Service as actions that create the likelihood of injury to a listed species to such an extent as to significantly disrupt normal behavior patterns, which include but are not limited to breeding, feeding, or sheltering. And basically, the species is protected from take wherever it occurs. When we talk about most of what we're talking about today, we're going to refer to things like habitat versus non-habitat. We also are talking about the range where this bird occurs. So the challenge with this is that if somehow a lesser prairie chicken ended up in Iowa and somebody shot it, they would still be in violation of the Endangered Species Act, even though that area is not part of the bird's range. And it sounds weird to talk about with the lesser prairie chicken, but it is something that we do encounter with species like wolves every once in a while. So it's important to clarify that, I think.
Drew Ricketts, a Kansas State Wildlife Extension specialist on the lesser prairie chicken. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We now have the final ag trade numbers for the first 11 months of 2023, and they're pretty much as expected. USDA economist Mark Kinder gave us the figures.
Agricultural exports for January through November 2023 are $159.4 billion, down 11% from the previous year. And agricultural imports were $179.3 billion, down 2%. From last year.
That makes for an ag trade deficit of almost $20 billion. Kinder says bulk products are seeing the biggest declines.
Wheat exports for January through November 2023, $5.6 billion, down 28% from the previous year. Corn exports were $12 billion, down 31%. Soybean exports, $25.4 billion, down 14%.
Cotton exports, $5.5 billion, 36% less than for the 2022 year. Gary Crawford, Washington.